Rita Coolidge's soulful voice contributed unforgettably to the soundtrack of a generation. Her talent, beauty, and authenticity inspired many of her contemporaries, and some even immortalized her in songs. With her then-husband, Kris Kristofferson, she formed one of pop culture's hottest supercouples on and off the stage. Now the Grammy Award winner opens up about her path from Tennessee to stardom in her memoir, Delta Lady, a candid chronicle of her life and career in and out of the spotlight. And it is a great pleasure to welcome Rita Coolidge to the roundtable. Rita, thank you very much for being with us. What a great thrill to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. So at what point did you say, okay, it's time for me to write this story?
You know, I think that people have been asking me to write this book for years, and one person in particular is my drummer in my band, Lynn Coulter, who's been with me about 17 years, and honestly, he just finally wore me down. And it seemed like a good time, because I always tell stories when I'm performing about the songs, and things pop up from time to time that he had never heard before, and he said, you got to write this stuff down. So we kind of put the feelers out to the publishing companies and got a great response. So it was, you know, the wheels started turning and the book is out, and it's kind of like having a baby. You know, she's out there now and she's breathing on her own and she's really doing well.
And you certainly get that impression reading the book that there's a lot of great stories. Started out in Tennessee, at what point did music come into your view as something that you would want to do?
I think that it's something I was born with. I always say that I didn't pick music. Music picked me, because I sang from the time I was, before I could talk, I could hum melodies. And I sang in church with my sisters when I was 2 years old. I sang harmonies when I was still practically a baby. So it has been such a big part of my life for my whole life.
You could sing before you could talk.
That's what my mother would tell me. She said, I would put you in a rocking chair, and the second you started rocking, you would hum, I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, and hum the whole thing and couldn't say a word. I believe everything my mother told me.
You had a brush with death when you were just a teenager that really kind of solidified the strength and the resolve that allowed you to go ahead with such fierceness into this profession and really into life.
I think so. I was 13 years old. It was a couple of days before I was 14. And I was driving in Nashville with my parents, and a car came across the median on this highway, Dickerson Road, and hit us in a head-on collision. And I was thrown through the windshield and had multiple lacerations in my face, and an artery I was bleeding out from an artery, and this man came out of nowhere. My mother's legs were fractured, and Daddy had been knocked unconscious. And this strange man came out and applied direct pressure to this artery to staunch the bleeding. And when the ambulance came and they got me into the ambulance, and my mother looked around to thank this man, he was gone, and we never found out who he was. But I had 60 stitches in my face, which is devastating for a 13-year-old girl, and spent probably a month at home, not able to go back to school, because of the bruising, and it just was unsightly that people would walk in and look at me and cry. And when I did go back to school, because teenagers can be so mean, I found a note that one girlfriend had written that said, Rita's a teenage Frankenstein. And it just broke my heart, but it also made me so much stronger. And I think that the fact that when I went to see my sister Priscilla at the University of Tennessee, got out of the car, it was a couple of months after the accident, and I got out of the car and walked into her arms, and she just looked at me and smiled and said, you're beautiful, you look great, you're going to be the next Miss America. And just that affirmation from my sister, whom I loved more than anyone, just gave me strength to get through that, and and likewise through other things that have been as overwhelming. That just learn to get through it and to get strong, gain strength, and to just go forward.
In growing up in Tennessee, you initially went to Memphis. What was that music scene like in the early days? And you do capture it in the book of what a learning opportunity it was.
Well, I had just graduated from Florida State, and I went to Memphis because my dad was a preacher and had a church in Memphis. So they'd moved from Florida. And when I got to Memphis, I had expected that I would maybe teach school. And when I got there, I realized that there were so many universities and so many teaching applications already in front of me that wasn't going to work for me. And so I immediately started exploring the music business in Memphis, which was vibrant and different from any place else in the country, especially over at Stax Volt Records, because at Stax there were no color lines. Everybody was the same. And there were Booker T and the MGs, two of the guys were black, two of the guys were white. Delaney and Bonnie Bramlett recorded their album at Stax, and they were a white band. And I would work at Stax. It was amazing at that time, because we were just on the heels of civil rights. And I think until Martin Luther King was assassinated, and I was there, it was in Memphis, and I felt those barriers of color immediately go up, and everything changed after that. And Stax Records pretty much folded not long after that. Booker moved to California. People just left. So it was really a time of transition in that city on so many levels.
When did you know it was time for you to move to California?
I had met Delaney and Bonnie and Leon Russell when they came to do the Stax record, and was hanging out with them and with Leon. And when they finished the album and were ready to go back to California, Leon invited me to drive to California with him. And it seemed like the perfect chance. I just packed a suitcase, left everything else with Priscilla, and drove Leon to California. And I never looked back. I think I had somebody send me some more clothes, because I didn't have very much at that time. And I just stayed in California. I had recorded a record for a company called Pepper Records when I was in Memphis. And by the time we drove across the country and arrived in Los Angeles, this record had become a regional hit in only maybe three cities in the United States, and one of them was Los Angeles. So I walked into a city, and everybody knew who I was. So I had opportunities, the amazing opportunities, to sing with other people and doing television, and consequently I became a session singer and contractor. And so I really feel so blessed that so many doors were open to me at that time and many other times.
You do write in the book that one of your favorite gigs as a background singer was recording vocals on Stephen Sills's Love the One You're With. That opened doors for you.
It opened many different kind of doors.
Yes, yes.
Because the night we recorded Love the One You're With, I had never met Graham Nash and Stephen Stills, and I was on the session with my sister and a group of other singers, but that night I could tell that Graham had kind of had eyes for me, and so did Stephen. And after we finished the session, Graham asked me if I wanted to come to the concert the next night at Universal where they were playing, and I didn't know if he was inviting me as a guest or if he was asking me on a date. But he gave me a phone number. He said, "I'm staying at Stevens. If you can call me there tomorrow, and we'll figure it out." So I called, and Stephen answered the phone, and he said, "Graham's made other arrangements, but I'd like to pick you up." And I realized that I felt at that time that it just had been an invitation. So I went with Stephen, and I got to the concert, and Graham was very cool, didn't talk to me, and was with no one else. So, you know, I think that I realized that something was amiss, and I went out with Stephen a few times, and finally Graham and I finally did talk, and I explained to him that I hadn't stood him up, and he said, well, I didn't stand you up either. He said, Stephen told me when you called that you had changed your mind and that you wanted to, that you were going with him. And Stephen was, he was a little charmer, but he also was just a little rascal. So he had basically just lied to both of us. And Graham and I did get together, and before we started our relationship, we went over and to Stephen's house and confronted Stephen, and he just came out swinging like a little pit bull. And they worked together over the next year, but they didn't. Stephen held a lot of resentment for Graham and me. He felt like Graham had taken his girlfriend, but I never was his girlfriend. And to this day, I get the blame for breaking up Crosby, Stills, and Nash, which they didn't really break up. They just didn't get along very well. But I have to say, there were so many problems in that band before I ever got there with all three of them.
With that said, you point out that really you and Graham didn't even break up. You just sort of drifted apart.
We did. And we're still very close. We still have stayed in touch all these years. Graham had a house up in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, and David Crosby lived up in Marin County, and Graham's friends were, his good friends all lived in San Francisco. He didn't spend that much time in Los Angeles until we started dating, and he was on the road a lot, and he started renovating the house up in Haight-Ashbury, and I didn't really love San Francisco that much. It was my friends and my family were all in Los Angeles by then, and so we just kind of drifted apart in a personal relationship, but we've maintained our friendship for all these years.
You write in the book, there's a chapter about the song Layla. You write about your uncredited but essential contribution to that hit. How did that come about, and ultimately, how were you left out?
Well, it came about that Jim Gordon was the drummer with Delaney and Bonnie. He was probably the best-known drummer in Los Angeles and in New York. He was so great. He would do sessions in New York in the morning and fly to L.A. and do sessions at night. He was in great demand. And Jim and I were dating, and we'd written a song. He came over to my house one afternoon and played like a 4 or 5 chord progression for me, and that's all it was, just chord progression. And I said, that's beautiful, let's write a song. And so I wrote a melody and I wrote lyrics to the song. It was called Time, Don't Let the World Get in Our Way. And we did a demo, and we were in England a couple of months later, and we had taken a demo to Eric Clapton for him to hear and possibly record on his first solo album. And Jim and I sat down at the piano and played the song, and I sang it for Eric. And we left the demo cassette on the piano, and nothing ever came of it. He didn't record it for the album. And about a year later, I was in the studio having promotional pictures made, and I suddenly hear this music come over the PA. And it was familiar. I recognized it, but I hadn't recorded it. And I heard more, I just started screaming, that's my song. I wrote that. This is my music. And I tried to contact Robert Stigwood, who was Eric's manager, because I'd found the album and my name was not on it. It was Layla, and it was the coda part of Layla. And when I called, I couldn't get straight to Eric because Robert Stigwood, or Stiggy, intercepted everything for Eric at that time. And I called him and said, why is my name left off? I wrote the coda. I wrote part of the coda with Jim. And he said, yeah, what are you going to do about it? You're a girl. Are you going to go up against Stiggy? Who do you think you are? So there was really nothing I could do at that time. I didn't have the funds to do a legal battle, and even the people around me, my producer, David Anderle, Jerry Moss, people just said, you know what, right now you can't afford to fight this, so you just have to tell your story and see what happens. And so I have told my story for all these years, but I've never written about it until I wrote the book.
Rita Coolidge is our guest. The book is Delta Lady, a memoir. 1971, your first album comes out, Rita Coolidge, and it gets great reviews. You're 25 years old. Time magazine is featuring you in a story along with other prominent women singers. And this is around the time that you meet Kris Kristofferson.
It was that very week, I think. I was going to Memphis to rehearse with my band, the Dixie Flyers, and Kris was on the same flight to stop in Memphis, and he was going on to Nashville for the cover of Look magazine. And when I got on the plane, Kris had saved me a seat. We had met at the ticket counter, and I sat down next to Kris, and the rest is, as they say, history. We just felt like we had known each other forever. We talked all the way to Memphis, and when we got to Memphis, he got off the plane with me and went to Nashville the next day. And before we fell asleep that night, we had named our child. We knew that we would marry. And it was just, unlike any other relationship or any other experience I've had. Unfortunately, we could not be married because Kris had a wandering eye, as they say. He was somewhat of a womanizer, or women just had no boundaries with him. I mean, even if we were a family and we were on the road traveling in airports, women would all but knock me down to get to Kris while he's carrying our baby on his shoulders. So it just became such a struggle for me. And at some point, I couldn't live with the womanizing more than anything.
And you do say it was a volatile relationship, and you do say that a lot of it had to do with you had two very big personalities in one relationship.
We did. We were both very strong people, and you know, we had our arguments or campaigns or wars or whatever they were, but you know, and I think every time I felt that someone was trying to control me, and I'm still the same way, that if I feel I'm in a relationship with a controlling person, I'm not comfortable with that. I really feel like it needs to be a partnership, and people have to support each other equally. I really want to be 50% of what's going on, and it just became every time we had another argument and more controlling The good times were literally outweighed by the sadness that I would feel every time a little bit of me would just, my heart would break, until one day I had asked him all along to go to marriage counseling with me and to see somebody, and he'd say, well, I'm fine, you're the crazy one, you go. So he never was willing to get outside help. Until I had left, and then he was ready to do anything, but it was too late.
You also write about in that time that after being with, in a very much a rock and roll setting of Delaney and Bonnie and the Joe Cocker and Eric Clapton tours, that when you were attending these concerts with Kris Kristofferson, you write that this was my first realization that this is what I wanted to do with my career. I didn't want to be where rock and roll was going. I didn't want to be a screamer. I wanted to move people's hearts. And that became a real conscious decision musically for you.
It definitely did, because I had toured with bands who, and I loved every minute that I worked with Delaney and Bonnie, but they were a rock and roll band, and also Mad Dogs and Englishmen. The whole goal of those concerts were to get people on their feet and dancing. And I went to Kris's concert and sat in the audience, and I felt Chris through his songs and his speaking. I just felt people's hearts being moved more than their feet. And to me, that was just something that I wanted to feel as an audience member, and it's something that I wanted to communicate as a solo artist. I wanted to be able to move people's hearts. And it's something, I mean, every time I go in the studio, people are saying to me, even as I go in for this next record, people are saying, now you can't just have ballads on the album. You have to have some up-tempo things. And it's always a struggle for me to find the right up-tempo songs that speak to me, because ballads just move me. And I love ballads. They're the ones that I always... The first songs that are chosen, and then I have to scramble to find the up-tempo songs.
In finding those songs and the beautiful songs that you found and you worked on, did you feel that there was... Because there's a point where people start coming to you with good stuff, right? What were you looking for in the song that would ultimately go in this direction that you wanted to go?
Well, I always listen to songs, and it really is how they move me, because no matter what stage of development a song is presented, I think, if the heart of the song and the lyric is something that speaks with the same voice that the music speaks, then it's something that, it's a song that will just move my heart. Sometimes I'll hear something and just can barely breathe. It's so beautiful. So on that level, those are the songs that definitely are going to go on the record. Again, it's more difficult for me to find up-tempo songs that have great lyrics, but it is possible. And as I am gathering material for the next album, I am finding those songs.
You write in the book, I mean, you write in about the relationship with Kris Kristofferson, and you talk about his drinking and the drugs, and you talk about losing so many people to drugs and a switch in the 60s and 70s from pot to cocaine. And how were you able to work through all of that? So many of your colleagues succumbed to it. How were you able to work through that scene?
Well, honestly, I give all the credit to my parents, who were the greatest parents in the world, and to the solid foundation that they gave me and my brother and my sisters of love and support and being able to make the right choices and having respect for myself. And never, ever asking what do you want to do when you grow up. For them, it's who do you want to be when you grow up. And they focus so much on that with their children that we all are very strong and really have a very high moral standard. And it's carried me through my lifetime. And I adored my parents. I lost them both in 2012, and I held them both as they crossed over. And that love is still as present today as it ever was.
The name of the book is Delta Lady. Tell us a little bit about that, of how that song came about.
Well, that's a song that Leon Russell had written for me when I was still living at Leon's house. And Joe Cocker was coming into Leon's studio. It was called the Sky Hill Drive Studio. And Joe was coming in to record, and Leon had written Delta Lady for Joe to record. And he did record it, and all of the imagery in the song is some of it is purely poetic on Leon's part. I never stood wet and naked in the garden. I would like to always clear that up when people say, "Oh, Delta Lady was written about you."
So get that out
but
there.
It not only was a great song and a hit record for Joe, but it became my handle on the Cocker Tour and has followed me all of my life. And I had a two-disc compilation on Universal a few years back, and the name of that was Delta Lady. So when we came to the book and choosing the title, it was pretty easy because it seems to be recognizable, and people have always called me the Delta Lady. So that's how we got the title on the Cocker Tour and for the book as well.
When you go out and you perform, are there still songs that you, obviously that the audience expects, that but you still just adore and love and have a very special place in your heart?
I think that, I mean, the little that I know when I recorded Higher and Higher and We're All Alone and some other songs, that I would be singing them every single concert for the rest of my life. But I think because I look in the audience and I see the joy on people's faces when the drum starts, the countdown on Higher and Higher and the kick drum, and then the keyboard comes in with the da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da-da. Just go nuts because they love the song. So every time I sing it with a different audience, it becomes brand new for me again. And I think that as years go by and people are in my life and relationships change, I sing some songs and they have such a different meaning than they did because something has happened in my life that relates to this song in a different way. So it, you know, because I love music so much, they all become brand new again at some point. But honestly, the greatest joy is to look at and see how much people love the music. We're an all-time high. We'll change all that's gone before. Doing so much more than falling in love. On an all-time high. We'll take on the world and win. So hold on tight. Let the flight begin.
Does something like when you did the soundtrack for Octopussy, and you're doing a Bond film, a song for a Bond film, All Time High, does that open you to a new audience in a way?
Well, I think it was just great, great exposure because that song has been played more than a million times. It got won an award the year it was released for being the most played record of the year. So I think that a lot of people became aware of my music through the James Bond through Octopussy and All Time High. And it's also given me great times. I was able to meet Prince Charles and Princess Diana at the royal premiere of Octopussy. And consequently, I was in Belgium for the 50th anniversary and sang with the Belgian Symphony Orchestra. They were the orchestra that played all the music on this silent film, The Artist, a few years back. Just a brilliant orchestra. And I was back in Germany in September or November before the last James Bond film came out. And once again, Octopussy and All Time High took me to a great place to sing the music again. So it's been a real joy to be a Bond singer and to have that on my resume.
So what is the new album?
The new album is still in the planning, and I want to be in the studio. I want to go back and make records the way we made records in the 70s. I want everybody that's playing on the record to be there playing while I'm singing, and we're all recording at the same time. That's the way I work with my band, and that's the way I record. And I'm looking forward to making a record, hopefully, that is more like the records that I made in the 70s. I mean, I've done so many different genres of music since then. I've done jazz, I've done Native American music, just pop music, and made some really cool records. But this one, I'm putting in a lot of pre-production and a lot of planning, and I just really want it to be the best record I've ever made.
Well, in the meantime, there's a beautiful memoir out. It's entitled Delta Lady, and it's published by Harper. Rita Coolidge, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us this morning.
I've enjoyed talking to you so much, and thank you, Joe.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Rita Coolidge's memoir is Delta Lady. The book is published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Outside the rain begins, and it may never end. So cry no more on the shore, a dream will take us out to sea. Forevermore. Close your eyes.